world. We're coming to you live from MVP Days 2017 Vancouver Edition. I'm here with my fellow co-host, all-around good guy, Clint Wyckoff.
Hey everybody, I'm Clint. I am a Microsoft MVP by day. I work for Veeam Software, but today, that's not why I'm here to talk to you. We're here to talk to you about Hyper-V performance troubleshooting. And this is a really fun session that Dave and I have actually given a couple of different times last year. But the nice part about it this time around is we've taken the time to update it and take into consideration a lot of the things that have changed now that Windows Server 2016 is finally generally available and ready to go there for you guys. So, pull that down. All right, so again, if you're active on Twitter, be sure to give myself a follow, at Clint Wyckoff, and tweet out to the hashtags MVP Hour there to give yourself a chance to win.
For everybody following online, if you unfollow Clint right now so that I can get closer to him in Twitter numbers, I will give you a free book, unfollowclint.com.
So before we get going here, how many people in the room actually run Hyper-V in your environments today? Any of you? Couple of you? How many of you guys, Carrie, we know you do. How many of you guys run VMware vSphere? Okay? Several of you? How many of you guys run both? A world of kind of dual hypervisor. And that's honestly what we're starting to see more and more is individual use cases and things come up, whether it be VDI or remote branch offices or specific applications. We're starting to see more customers, whether it be VMware or Hyper-V, or either Acropolis hypervisor on Nutanix, for instance, or KVM, OpenStack in other environments. We're starting to see a lot more of the kind of world of dual hypervisor ship come along.
And I think it's actually even beyond a dual hypervisor now, because now I think you have to bring Amazon, Azure, and Google into the mix as well. So show of hands for how many of you are running even a single workload in Azure or testing up there, or built a VM up in Azure. And you know what? We would ask that question 2-3 years ago, we wouldn't get any hands that would go up. And so we actually have organizations in Alberta that are actually moving their production data centers 100% to Azure right now, or have already gotten there. And so we're starting to see a huge shift. So everything we're gonna show you today is going to play true into all of those environments.
Absolutely.
So it's not just on-prem, it's also gonna be in the cloud, and it's also going to be hyper-converged as well.
Yeah, absolutely. There's going to be some specific things that we're going to talk about from a technology perspective that relate directly to Hyper-V, but the core concepts behind the scenes relate to really any type of environment that you're troubleshooting, right? Because we're going to be talking about networking, we're going to be talking about storage, we're going to talk a little bit about applications, okay? So, but before we get to all of that, we're going to start off with a basic introduction of Hyper-V, because some of you run it today, some of you don't run it. Then we're going to dive into some of the performance bottlenecks and gotchas and how to troubleshoot and what to take into consideration whenever you're looking at your storage and your networking stack. Because as you all know, whenever you virtualize, it touches all different parts of the entire infrastructure. It's not just the application. It's just not the compute. There's the network and storage. And those are probably the two most common areas for problems inside of any environment. And then, Dave, we're actually going to talk about some management monitoring, talk about the ecosystem, and then at the end, hopefully we'll have time for some Q&A, but as part of that Q&A, some of the things that we just want to have a back and forth conversation about some of the tools and how you guys troubleshoot problems inside of your environment today. But the first area we're going to focus on is availability. And availability is very important, especially if you're starting to, or you're continuing to virtualize more and more apps and services. You need to make sure that those are able to be up and running at all times. So, really quick question for somebody out there online or here in the audience with us today live is, you know, in Hyper-V world, how does Microsoft kind of group together the host servers? What technology is used? Anybody know to group together? Windows failover clustering. You win a golden star for the day. Yes, in the Microsoft world, it is, in fact, David, if you didn't know that, it is Windows failover clustering, right? So then, if you were to equate that over to, say, for instance, the VMware side, you know, you create a cluster inside of vCenter, and you're able to have a group of host servers together, right? So you can live migrate or vMotion or storage vMotion, the same exact thing in the Hyper-V world too.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, when we talk about, you know, the performance and scalability of these systems, making sure that, you know, your underpinning components are working properly is very, very important. The other thing that's really important is understanding the construct of what the application is that's running inside of your VM as well. Because as you start to move your workloads up to a cloud provider, you're not necessarily going to have the ability to see and get a deep dive inside of that infrastructure in the same way that it was if it was on-prem.
Absolutely. So here on the right-hand side is just kind of a very basic diagram of, you know, what an environment, shared compute, converged infrastructure, right? We hear a lot about hyper-converged. Well, the way that things have been done over the last course of, you know, several years is in a converged manner where everything is completely separate. So down here on the bottom, I have my shared external SAN device. That can be a NetApp, that can be an EMC, that can be a Nimble storage array, for instance. And then I have my host servers that are running my virtual machines and my apps and services. So if anyone in here has ever tried to call Microsoft support, you know, my first failover cluster that I ever built wasn't Hyper-V, believe it or not. It was SQL Server, in fact. So whenever I was on your side of the fence, we were a huge fan of SQL Server, and we had a lot of different named instances for our production development and QA environments. And whenever you go ahead and enable Windows failover clustering, it saves out a report. Where in this report really contains everything about all the nodes inside of that cluster. So it contains BIOS information, driver information, firmware information, disk information. So anytime you ever call Premier or Microsoft support for any problems about a failover cluster, whether it's SQL or Hyper-V or Exchange, for instance, if you're running kind of an older version of Exchange, the reports are saved in that directory.
And we talked a little bit about storage spaces direct. You weren't in that session earlier today, but when you configure storage spaces direct using failover clustering, all the storage spaces direct configuration information is actually stored in that same folder because it's part of the failover cluster services. Okay, so if you're going to enable Microsoft's hyper-converged infrastructure by using storage spaces direct, you can gain a lot of information by looking in that folder. So do I have anybody in here that's consultants? So anybody that's consultants or goes around to different organizations, anybody that ever has to poke around blind inside of an environment, you have no idea what you're getting called into, just, it's broken, Dave, please come fix it. Well, what do you have? I have no idea what I have. Why don't we go dive in? That failover clustering validation report and the reports that are in there are golden to me because now I can see your nodes, I can see RAM, I can see disk, I can see, like Clint said, the BIOS, the firmware levels, driver levels, patch levels. I can see all of that stuff for all your nodes inside the Hyper-V cluster. Are always stored there. So the biggest part of this, though, is if you do want that support from Microsoft, if you ever have to phone them, your test not only has to run, it has to pass. So if it doesn't pass, they can actually say, go make it pass, and then call us back, because it's running through all of those tests to make sure that all your shared storage and disk arbitration and stuff like that is working properly. So before you go into prod, you should probably make sure that that report passes, because otherwise you're going to be in a world of hurt if you have to phone Microsoft for support.
Yeah, if you ever actually go through and rerun the validation tests, there's a non-disruptive test that you can do, and then there's also the disruptive version of the test as well, where it takes the disks offline, brings them back online, makes sure that it can move the disks, the clustered shared volumes, from one host to another host, and it's able to be brought online inside of a cluster. So scalability, this is really important because, you know, especially if you compare or look back over the course of the last few years, you know, a lot of the VMware guys out there always like to tout some of the metrics. You know, vSphere supports this amount of virtual hard disks, or I can have this many virtual CPUs or this much memory inside of a virtual machine. Well, the nice part to understand and realize is the fact that Hyper-V as well, especially inside of Windows Server 2016. Now, these numbers here are kind of the upper bounds of scalability that I don't know if they've necessarily been tested, and just because you can doesn't mean you should. However, you know, Hyper-V 2016 is now able to support up to a terabyte worth of memory inside of a single virtual machine, or 64 virtual processors inside of a VM. So now we're able to virtualize much more of those large, massive applications that we might not have been able to virtualize inside of Hyper-V previously, now with Windows Server 2016.
Can I just get a show of hands if anybody's using a terabyte of RAM inside of one of their VMs? Jeepers. I never get anybody raising their hand.
Never, no. And if you were
one of those people, I would love to come over to your organization and take a picture of that monster server that's hosting that, because that would be cool.
Quite expensive too.
Yes.
Now, the most I ever had was 48 gigabytes worth of memory inside of an individual virtual machine. And we actually gave that one-to-one. So we deployed on IBM Blades. And we actually deployed that individual server. It was still a virtual server, but they had a dedicated Blade environment just for that specific application, where they had a couple of VMs, all of which had 48 gig.
And it's getting to be more common to have these, what I consider moving back into the super compute world of things, because having 256 gigs of RAM in a host server is not uncommon anymore. Having even 512, customers maxing that out, is not uncommon, because they want to really maximize and leverage the density of what's there. And where you see the environments that really push, you know, the compute of your hypervisor to the end limits, one workload specifically, Clint, pushes this more than anything else I've seen, and that's VDI or Citrix Farms and stuff like that, because you spin up so many instances of those virtual desktops that you're maxing out your procs and you're maxing out your.
Well, that also places a lot of strain on your underlying storage infrastructure
as well.
Especially, you know, in the morning when everybody's logging in, all that I/O.
Yep.
Yeah, it's called a boot storm. Anyone ever heard of that before?
Yeah.
So some of the deployment scenarios and considerations, you know, whenever you deploy Windows Server, which version is everybody deploying? Anyone in here using Server Core Edition at all? Alan, you use Server Core? What do you use Server Core for?
AD servers.
Active Directory?
AD, DNS.
Active Directory, DNS. In kind of the world that I come from, which is the disaster recovery space, we see a lot of our customers actually using Windows Server Core Edition for what are called Veeam proxy servers, and that makes a really great use case for Server Core Edition. But just realizing that, yes, there's a GUI version, yeah, there's a core version. Anyone in here doing anything with Nano Server inside of Windows Server 2016? It's kind of a new offering.
Does anybody know, or has everybody heard of Nano Server before?
Heard of it? Yeah.
All right. So when you take a look at ripping the GUI out and all these different versions of Hyper-V, when we talk about this from a performance standpoint, Clint.
Mm-hmm. That's why we're here today.
Is there any difference in the kernel for Hyper-V between the different versions? Windows 10, Windows Server 2016, mm-hmm. Core, GUI, Nano. Is there actually functionally any difference in the hypervisor?
So that's actually a really good question. And a lot of the testing with Hyper-V that I do in my life is actually done on a Windows 10 laptop device that I have. I have a 500 gig SSD drive in it. So to answer your question, Dave, no. The Hyper-V that's in Windows 10, the Hyper-V that's in Windows 8.1, the Hyper-V that's in Free Edition, Standard Edition, and Data Center Edition, it's all the same exact kernel across the board. So if you're not running Hyper-V, or you're looking at different use cases, or see, you know, how is this managed, how does it compare, you know, a great lab environment is even, you know, like I said, on your Windows 10.
It's portable,
absolutely, yeah.
And that's why you can actually live migrate your Hyper-V workloads from your Windows 10 laptop directly into your data center using Shared Nothing live migration, and it will work.
Yeah.
You may have to update your integration services afterwards because they may not be at the same rev, but it will work. That VM will spin up.
You can actually just go into, on a server, you can go into Server Manager and you can manually enable or add the Hyper-V role there. Or inside of your Windows 10 machine, you actually just go into the control panel there and you can add additional features, and it's just a checkbox. The binaries, the bits, they're already inside of the operating system. They're already baked in Windows Server 2016 Core as well as the GUI edition. Now, one of the unique parts of Nano Server, Dave, is the fact that everything is on an as-needed basis. So you only add in the roles and features that you want and need whenever you build out that ISO image for your Nano server. So whenever you build that, there's no server manager. There's no GUI that goes with Nano. Everything is added in on an ad hoc, as needed basis. So whenever you build that, there's actually a switch to add in Hyper-V. And all I've done here is I've included some of the PowerShell that you would actually be able to take and run inside of your Windows Server 2016 environment to enable the Hyper-V role, as well as create a standard virtual switch, give it a name, and create the window, add the Windows failover clustering role as well. So it's really easy, really simple, just a few short lines of PowerShell. Anyone love PowerShell? Yeah, a lot of you guys are raising your hand. This guy especially, yeah. So I'll be the first one to admit that I'm not the best PowerSheller, I guess if that's like the technical term, PowerShell writer. But I like to steal other people's PowerShell, and I like to make it my own. So I go out to my Google, and you know, boop, 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 and I copy, and I paste, and I change it, and I make it mine.
That's why I manage Hyper-V. If you can control C, control V, you can manage Hyper-V. That's right.
Marcos likes that one.
If you can control C, control V, you can destroy Hyper-V.
So probably one of the biggest areas of concern and limitations and considerations. So how many in here run 1 gig in their environment? Anybody? 1 gigabyte, 1 GB, 10 GB? Anyone doing 10 gig? Other hand? No? Either that or you all forgot to put deodorant on and you don't want to raise your hand. So if you're not running 1 gig or 10 gig, what are you running?
10. Pigeon.
Or you just don't want to raise your hand? A mix? Okay. Anyone running both?
Anybody okay. Still using pigeons? Pigeons? No?
So what do you see, right? So you're a consultant. You're out with meeting with folks on a daily basis, yep. And talking about this stuff. What do you see whenever you meet with the customers and clients that you chat with?
I still see a lot of 1 gig out there inside of their infrastructure. In fact, I'm configuring a large Hyper-V farm right now, Clint, where we're converting 30 different VMware hosts over to Hyper-V, and they didn't want to change the underlying infrastructure. So we're actually converting 30 hosts over to Hyper-V, leaving all the infrastructure the same on all gig infrastructure, just because they want to reuse that gear. So as we migrate the workloads off, they give us a couple more nodes for the Hyper-V cluster, and we just kind of slowly start porting stuff over. And so they didn't want to spend a single dime of CapEx in order to do this, so that's how we did it. And so I still see that. And a lot of the newer infrastructure, a lot of the new servers actually come with 10 gig onboard LAN on motherboard ports. Plus, the cost of 10 gig infrastructure has come way down. Like, you can get some pretty nice switches for in around the $10,000, $15,000 mark. That, you know, those are enterprise-grade production switches. That, you know, that's really come down a lot. And even you're starting to see some customers even looking at 56 gig.
InfiniBand.
40 yeah. 56 and 100 gig. The problem is that the backplane that's inside of the servers that you're going to put those 100 gig cards in, it's actually, there's not enough lanes inside of there to fully utilize all of that speed. So to try to max that out is actually very, very challenging.
Yeah, so one, I think, a really important consideration to take into account is making sure that the upstream switches that you're going to plug into, whether that be a Cisco infrastructure or a Juniper environment or a Arista environment, is making sure that it fully supports the type of cards that you have inside of your servers or the protocols that the cards are going to be using. Anybody in here, say, for instance, running LACP or link aggregation or virtual port channeling inside of your environment, right? Ether channeling. That's important to make sure that you have your virtual switches configured correctly to work and to communicate over that same protocol that the switch is configured for, right? So you need to make sure that there's consistency across the board there. Making sure, you know, hey, I've got SFP switches for, not copper switches, and I need to make sure that the adapters that I'm getting or purchasing or have are SFP capable modules, right?
SFP Plus, yeah.
Yeah, SFP Plus. So we're seeing a lot of folks starting to move more towards some of the up-and-coming types of technologies like RDMA, network adapters, or remote direct memory access. And Dave, you've actually done a lot of testing with some of the newer Mellanox cards, so yep. You've heard of like Broadcom and Intel cards. There's another manufacturer out there that's called Mellanox, And they're actually within the Windows Server catalog, is fully supported, many other models, is fully supported on Windows Server 2016.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of the vendors that are out there that are building hyper-converged solutions today, Clint, are actually using the Mellanox cards as a card of choice, especially when it comes to Windows Server 2016. And if you're not using those Mellanox cards, you just want to make sure that whatever cards you're buying fully support RDMA, because not all of the older generation 10 gig cards are going to support that. You're leaving an awful lot on the table. We did a super cool demo in our Storage Spaces Direct session, Clint, where we were showing VM Fleet and using VM Fleet for stress testing. Mm-hmm. And when we were using VM Fleet for stress testing, I had actually built my lab in a non-RDMA configuration just because it was the gear that I had available. And then I had acquired a couple of those Mellanox cards for the lab. And the difference was pretty profound that we were seeing. You want to cut your CPU network utilization way down, you're going to take a need to do that. And it's actually not that expensive of an upgrade if you have an existing Hyper-V farm. You're talking in the hundreds of dollars, not in the thousands of dollars per host, per server to upgrade this. It's well worth your while to look into this. So if you leave MVP days, or if you're watching online, you want to take and make sure that you're doing some research into RDMA capabilities with your hypervisor.
So one of the limitations that was actually present in Windows Server 2012 R2, so if you were going to create a network team inside of Windows Server 2012, you could actually not have RDMA network adapters be part of that team. You had to actually create a separate virtual switch that was just for those RDMA network adapters. Within Windows Server 2016, you're now able to have RDMA NICs as well as non-RDMA NICs be a part of that same exact networking team.
Yeah, you know, when you take a look at the configurations, Clint, there was also one other kind of little hidden gem, and this is our performance session. So I always like to bring this one
up. Absolutely, this
is
a good one.
So how many of you guys have played with Hyper-V on 2008, 2012, or 2012 R2? Just Hyper-V guys at all? Just show of hands. Have you ever noticed when you go to configure that Hyper-V server, if you took a 10 gig adapter, if you've had a chance to play with that type of infrastructure, and you direct connected that to one of the other hosts, you would get full line speed. It would feel like, oh wow, I'm getting my full gigabyte per second copy going across here. And then the moment that you stood up your Hyper-V virtual switch and you added your Hyper-V virtual adapters on top, it felt like something was being choked out in that infrastructure. And the reason is, it was. It was actually by feature design that was set up that way. So you'd never get full line speed. You would only ever get a maximum of 300 to 500 megabytes per second going across that virtual adapter. So if you were taking that virtual adapter and you were trying to connect into your iSCSI farm, which you know we would do, we would connect to iSCSI or we would connect to some other NAS device, mm-hmm. It never seemed like we were ever getting full maximum performance. And it's because that virtual adapter and that virtual switch was actually bound to like a single CPU core. Now they fixed that for Windows Server 2016, and inside of Windows Server 2016, that's now 56 gigabytes per second.
That's huge improvements.
Yeah. On that virtual adapter, right? So 300 to 500 megs to 56 gigabit.
Yeah.
So you can get 5.6 gigabytes per second going across on that full adapter. Assuming you'd get full line speed, of course.
Yeah.
Right?
So Microsoft's actually made a lot of other performance improvements, especially in kind of the area of storage and shared storage. How many guys out there still have Fibre Channel? Connected Fibre Channel? iSCSI? A couple of iSCSI? Or do you guys use all network SMB3 or direct attach storage on your Hyper-V hosts? I see a couple of heads nodding. So whenever you go and actually deploy, so up here in the top red box, you see this REFS, Resilient File System. Microsoft has made huge improvements with REFS inside of Windows Server 2016. They've completely redone the way that they do checkpoints. They actually use an API that's present on the Resilient File System called the Block Clone API. So whenever you go out to take a checkpoint, it's actually going to simply use metadata updates to reference the existing blocks of data that are already on disk there. Whenever you're creating those checkpoints. So it makes checkpoints a lot more efficient, okay? Also within the checkpointing is it actually uses the same technology that's present inside of backups as well. So it's actually able to quiesce and capture the state of the memory whenever that virtual machine checkpoint is taken. The second kind of area here is the shared storage and being able to connect out to that shared storage via SMB3 or SMB Direct. That's where having the RDMA NICs comes into play. So you're connecting out to these shared storage devices via the network, right? Inside of a VMware world, this would be equivalent to like NFS, for instance, right? In the Microsoft kind of side of the fence, they use SMB3. And then, so this could also be down on the bottom with a Storage Spaces Direct Cluster, which is what Dave actually just talked about in the previous session. Did anybody check out the Storage Spaces Direct session? One of you guys did, a couple of you guys? Alan, you obviously did. You were one of the presenters. Or you can actually have a scale-out file server kind of serve up and be the shared storage for your Hyper-V host. The important piece to know that is inside of Server 2016, you want to run and format your virtual hard, the hard disks, your clustered share volumes, or your SMB shares, or your Storage Spaces Direct, using the Resilient File System, REFS 3.1. And I'm actually doing a session right after this just on REFS.
Well, and along those lines, the preferred file system that we have in 2016 for a Hyper-V farm is now REFS. And have you guys ever heard of something called BitRot before? Anybody heard of BitRot? BitRot going once, BitRot going twice. Have you guys ever seen the data that sits on an NTFS volume just seems to get a little shaky over time and check disks and disk integrity is just not great and all of a sudden seems to just get rotten on you? That's called BitRot. And so REFS actually helps fix that. So if the file system actually starts to detect that there's corrupt blocks of data and it can find other metadata across the other blocks, it'll take and just rebuild itself,
yeah.
Especially using Storage Spaces
Direct. So if you're using Mirror or using Parity, or otherwise known as erasure coding, whenever you create this Storage Spaces Direct cluster, it enables something called data integrity streams. And like I said, I'll talk about this in the session after this, but kind of one of the inherent capabilities that the resilient file system provides is resiliency. Imagine that they actually made something that's easily identifiable by the name, resilient file system, is it'll natively detect these corrupt files, this corrupt data on either your VHDX files or say for instance the entire cluster share volume, and it'll use that parity bit or use the mirror copy on my other hard disks to automatically correct the problems if it's able to.
Which is huge,
yeah. And like I said, I'm doing a session not to kind of derail the conversation around performance, but this is a huge improvement that Microsoft's made inside of Windows Server 2016.
Yes, absolutely.
So as we talked about a little bit earlier, here is some of the different deployment models. And inside of your traditional infrastructure, this is the one on the left being converged. This is the way that infrastructure has been deployed over the course of, you know, the last several different years, right? Being able to have my compute layer, my servers, my compute, and then be having my network stack, and then an external storage device, right? Everybody's familiar with this, right? This is the way that applications and services have been deployed. How many folks out there, is anybody doing anything with hyperconvergence? So Nutanix, Simplivity, Storage Spaces Direct, you're raising your hand, which?
vSAN,
that's an absolutely great example. So Microsoft, in their wise wisdom that they think they have, they've actually come out with a product, and we just mentioned this, is Storage Spaces Direct. So inside of Windows Server 2016, this is their kind of shared nothing, no requirement for any sort of external SAN device, much like vSAN is today. There's a lot of different nuances between each one of the two different products that make them distinctly different. However, just understanding that, well, the Storage Spaces Direct doesn't require any sort of external SAN. So this is all runs on commodity hardware with just a bunch of disk in each one of the Hyper-V nodes, and it forms out a software-defined storage array called Storage Spaces Direct. And in fact, the little cards that Alan is going around handing out gives you guys a 90-day trial to Pluralsight.
No, which is 30, I think so.
30 days? I think it's 30 days, 90 days. But anyhow, Dave and I are actually in the process of writing a course for Pluralsight on Storage Spaces Direct, so you guys can get free access to that when it becomes available.
That's an unlimited access to their full library, by the way, for a full month. It's very cool.
But the only one you want to go watch is ours.
That's right. You can watch it over and over and over and over again if you want.
You funny guy.
We're probably going to get our fingers wrapped for that. It's all right.
So let's talk about the SET team, Dave. Why is this important and what is it?
So the SET team, guys, is a switch-enabled team, and it's a new team type inside
switch-embedded
team. Sorry. It's a new team type that's available inside of Windows Server 2016. All right, and we talked a little bit about this in our Storage Spaces Direct course or course session earlier. Sorry. And what's important with this is that the prior generation of servers in 2012 R2, we could use stuff like RDMA client, but the problem was is that we couldn't bind it in using LBFO team, using switch independent.
What's LBFO stand for our folks?
I don't remember. Thanks for putting me on the spot.
Load balanced failover team.
Okay, thank you.
Maybe they didn't know.
So anyways, For the switch-enabled teaming guys, or switch-embedded teaming, the important part about this is when you take and you have this set up inside of your Hyper-V environments, you're going to take and be able to team RDMA adapters now. So what it means, you don't need dedicated ports specifically to run RDMA traffic. So now I can take a 2 or 4 port RDMA-enabled adapter, and I can set up a team. Now, how many of you guys have used the GUI in Windows Server 2012 R2 to use to set up teaming? Has anybody gone in like through Server Manager and like checked out the teaming and statistics and stuff like that? So when you go to set this up, this can only be done via PowerShell and managed via PowerShell. Okay, so you're not going to see it inside of the UI, so it's a little bit of a change for how you're used to doing things inside of Server 2016. So this is really, really important if you're looking to optimize the performance of your Hyper-V farm on 2016. This is the team type that you want to be looking for, especially if you're going to be upgrading and forklifting those adapters over to RDMA-capable ones. Sorry, we've done a lot of sessions over the last couple of days, and I just kind of, poof.
It all ends up blending together. We get to do it all again on Friday in Calgary.
I know. All of those concussions I had playing hockey, sometime they come back to bite me.
So we actually have a question from the audience.
This switch option is for storage, or
can you use it for anything? Yeah, yeah. You don't have to have this for Storage Spaces Direct. Like this will work just on your regular Hyper-V servers as well. So you can think of if I'm connecting to a scale-out file server that's also taking and running RDMA, and I want to use Packet Direct and stuff like that, SMB Direct, I can take and I can use this to get access across and speed up and turbocharge that.
Yeah, so just repeat the question for our viewers online. For
I don't remember what the question was.
The question was, is the SET team only able to be used inside of Hyper-V environments? Was that not the question? Is it able to be used in other deployments? Is it only targeted to storage? Yep. No, it is not only targeted to storage. So let's talk a little bit about management now. For the viewers online and for you guys here in the room, we actually do have some of the folks online asking some really great questions. And I think Alan and Marcos are taking care of those for us too. So managing Hyper-V clusters. Anybody in here ever run Virtual Machine Manager? System Center, Virtual Machine Manager, VMM. Do you need me to speak in Portuguese for you?
Yes.
Please? I can't do that. So several of you guys are running VMM. Is that how you manage your Hyper-V environments today still? Yeah? Yeah?
We're sorry.
Like VMM, it's a fantastic tool. Hint, hint, wink, wink. We actually prefer just traditional failover clustering manager. I think VMM is a fantastic tool, especially for larger environments, but it does have its limitations and nuances and complexities that you have to get around. So Virtual Machine Manager, Windows Failover Clustering Manager, are two different ways that you can manage Hyper-V environments. But kind of the third way leverages some third-party tools from other partners that we have out there.
Yeah, so there's a vendor that's out there, and they're actually one of our proud community sponsors of the show, Five9 Software. And they actually make products that are specifically purpose-built designed for Hyper-V. And one of those products is called Five9 Manager. And Five9 Manager is another way that you can get in there and manage. And you know what it's particularly great for, Clint? It's managing your nano servers. They were the first ISV that came out to the market with a nano server management UI, which, as if you guys have ever played with that, didn't seem like very many of you had a chance to. You have to do everything from the shell with nano server to get yourself started. So this gives you your kind of front-end UI on top of that, which is very, very cool.
Now, another way that you can actually manage your on-prem environment as well as your Azure environment is there's a marketplace application that you can deploy, a server manager utility out in Azure that'll actually connect into your on-prem environment and allow you to manage your servers all from a single web page utility outside in Azure. So if you have an Azure subscription, it's literally just in the Azure marketplace. I believe if you just do a search for server manager, you'll find it. I can't remember the name of it. It's totally just brain fart for a second. But we can check on that here and give you the name of that tool. But it's definitely out in the Azure marketplace. So I like to probably wrap things up here just in a few minutes with some of the obvious stuff. So does anybody live in a neighborhood, and I'm sure you guys all do, where you have a neighbor that you live by that their yard is absolutely hideous looking and it's completely overgrown?
I told you don't take pictures of my house.
That's Dave's
house. It's not nice.
Yeah, right here. His 19 kids live in that house with the ivy growing
all over. They like that.
But what's the problem with this guy is this guy doesn't take care of his own lawn, right? That is his problem. So how many of us actually live in an infrastructure where we have a hard time finding time to take care of our own lawn? And what I mean by that is taking care of the infrastructure stuff, making sure that our house is clean, our grass is cut, right? How many BIOS firmware driver revisions are you behind? Are they standard across the board? Like I said, whenever I was on your side of the fence, we had 280 some odd blades inside of our infrastructure. And it was a really hard time finding maintenance windows because all the application owners want to do their maintenance inside of the maintenance window, which leaves very little time for infrastructure guys to do their stuff. But making sure that you keep these components, BIOS, firmware, drivers, security updates, all up to date, relevant, and current. I couldn't tell you how many times you call a hardware support vendor to fix the problem and they realize that your BIOS or your driver or your firmware revision is like 4 or 5 revs back. Anyone ever had that happen? And you know, just like Microsoft says, hey, run the cluster validation report again, the hardware vendor says, well, guys, go update your stuff and then call me back. That's a really hard conversation to have because now you're in a system down situation and they want you to update all this stuff. It's just, so the point being is, you don't have to be on bleeding edge. You don't have to be on the latest and greatest versions of any of this stuff, but definitely within 1 or 2 revisions because they fix a lot of problems.
Well, and one of the other really big issues that you have from performance when it comes to Hyper-V, Clint, is something that I like to call integration services drift. And so if you guys aren't aware of this right now, when you patch your Hyper-V host server, there's going to be a new version of, and this is speaking for Windows 2012 R2, which is on the platform most of you are on, you're going to get a new version of your integration services that are going to be available for your virtual machines. You have to upgrade those. Now, if you don't upgrade those, what ends up happening is you could have a big drift across all those different versions. So you want to apply a Hyper-V hotfix or a patch or something like that, and that version number changed, but all of a sudden you're running older versions on all of your virtual machines. That could dramatically impact your performance because that's where they're going to inject all the hotfixes into the VMs, is through those VM guests. It's like your VM tools, right? And so there's actually, we're going to have a slide at the end that's called the Hyper-V reporting script. It's a PowerShell HTML UI that you guys, or sorry, PowerShell HTML report that you can run on your Hyper-V farm, and it'll list out all of your VMs and it'll show if your integration services are up to date on there. So you get a kind of a to-do list if you are falling behind. Now, as you can imagine, in a larger farm, Clint, this was a big issue for large customers that ran Hyper-V because, to be quite frank, updating and staying on top of these integration services was a pain in the butt.
It's a, regardless of what hypervisor you run. So if you run VMware, yeah. every time you run any type of security updates or updates on your vSphere host, most oftentimes the tools gets increased, right? So then you have to go out and you have to patch all your virtual machines with the latest version of VMware tools. I think it's even more prevalent in the Hyper-V world because you're traditionally patching your Windows servers a lot more frequently than you are, like say for instance, a VMware host. So you can have more of that integration services drift inside of a Windows server environment than you would maybe inside of a VMware infrastructure. So the important part to note here is that now inside of Windows Server 2016, integration services is actually updated automatically as part of Windows updates. So if you're using WSUS or Config Manager or any other third-party patching tools, or however, if you're just going out to windowsupdates.com, that integration services is now updated directly from the Microsoft website.
So if your guests are actually yep. using any type of Windows update, they're going to be updated along the course with that, with
right.
that
so
process.
This, that's the issue
that's
that
a
was prevalent
huge
that we
change
just
for 2016.
Talked about is
huge.
A big update yep. inside of Windows Server 2016.
And you got to understand that now you're kind of fully patched and fully serviced all the time. It inherently gets rid of a lot of back-end problems that you would take and typically see with a Hyper-V farm. That was actually, me personally, Clint, that was actually one of my favorite enhancements for Windows Server 2016. There's a lot of them, but that was a big one because that was something that was
right.
really big pain.
So kind of the key takeaway there for everybody is to update, right? Make sure your components, your servers, your hosts are, like I said, don't have to be running the latest and greatest, the bleeding edge, but at least be within a few revisions. So at this point, I actually wanted to ask you, Dave, you know, you meet, like I said earlier, you meet with a lot of partners and customers and things like that. As you go out and meet with them, what types of tools do you see them using to troubleshoot, to monitor, to make sure that their systems are up? How are they taking care of their performance inside of their environment?
Well, and I think the big thing is you know, when you look at these tools of the trade is to find something that can give you some type of level of application visibility, right? So that you can take a look at, you know, monitoring the stuff properly. And I think if you guys weren't aware of this right now, how many of you guys have heard of the Operations Management Suite or OMS for Azure?
I think I've heard of that before.
Have you?
Yeah, I saw it on marketing like once.
There's a Hyper-V, there's a Hyper-V module inside of there now. So I think that released about 3 to 4 months ago. So you can actually monitor all your Hyper-V performance via OMS. So that is very cool because you can actually get yourself a pretty reasonably priced subscription to OMS to get yourself started. And I think Emil actually did a session on freemium monitoring for OMS earlier this morning. Did anybody sit Emil's session, the OMS session earlier? So along the same lines of what you learned earlier today, you can do that. So that's one. There's also some really, really cool free monitoring tools as well. I think Veeam has one, right? Isn't there like a Hyper-V task manager?
Yeah, there is a Hyper-V task manager. So if you've ever actually gone into the task manager.
We're having fun with this session.
A task manager on your Hyper-V host to try to figure out which virtual machines are using, how much memory or how much CPU. We actually have it completely free. It doesn't cost anything. Veeam loves to give away free tools. You can actually download this Hyper-V Task Manager and install it on an external, like on your management machine, and then you can connect to your Hyper-V hosts, and it'll show you kind of a task manager view. You know, my SQL server is using this much memory, this much CPU, or my Exchange server, my domain controller, for instance. You can actually drill into it and see performance usage of virtual machines from a task manager type view.
No licensing.
It's completely free.
Don't you guys have a specific blog that's dedicated to Hyper-V at Veeam as well? Isn't it just hyperv.veeam.com?
Yeah, we do have a hyperv.veeam.com. There's a blog that we write on as well very frequently. Question?
Yeah, I was just wondering, we use VMware, so we don't use Hyper-V, but is there not anything built in with the Hyper-V management, like the already existing use, that you can see all of that performance data?
Yeah, there's performance monitor counters.
There are performance, you'd have to go into Perfmon and look at specific counters to try to even, the problem is the virtual machines run inside of the parent partition of the operating system. And they're seen inside of Task Manager is a worker process that's running in the background. So it doesn't say, this virtual machine is using this much memory, this virtual machine is using that much memory. It's kind of a guessing game. It's really actually very tough to get that info.
So the stock answer from Microsoft is SCOM. And the stock answer from Microsoft is Virtual Machine Manager. So if you just loaded Virtual Machine Manager, you'd get the kind of graphs and bars and stuff like what you'd see. It's not even close to vCenter, but it's Microsoft's version of that. And SCOM will allow you to dive in at the application layer. But SCOM could actually go way deeper than just the hypervisor, because it can go inside the apps, and it can go inside .NET, and it can do a lot more. And then Microsoft's even extending that out into OMS. So natively, if you didn't have VMM, it would be like running ESXi. And so whatever you'd see out of ESXi with no vCenter is kind of what you'd see natively out of Hyper-V. And then you layer on the management stack on top, and yeah, you can see better application visibility. So there are ways to do it. But these are just some of the additional tools.
Yeah. I would say that that's probably the biggest area where Microsoft has and can improve is on the management layer. That's just my opinion.
It's been like that for a long while.
So before we wrap things up here, Dave mentioned that Hyper-V reporting tool. Again, this is something completely free. So if you just go out to the TechNet gallery, the PowerShell out there, and do a search for the Hyper-V reporting script, you can actually run this inside of your environment. All it does, it's read-only. It's not going to make any changes. And it'll give you a really good output in HTML format. There's the PowerShell deployment toolkit. SysInternals is a really great has a really great suite of tools. That's actually something that Mark Rasinovich is still a proud parent of. And then you've got OMS, Ops Manager, and we mentioned the Veeam Hyper-V Task Manager. These are our personal favorite tools that we like to look at.
That one that's at the very top of the list, guys, that one there is what I build for my daily Hyper-V health check reporting script, because it has a mail to function on it. So I actually just mail myself that report from a Hyper-V farms that I manage, and it runs on a cluster, individual nodes. So for example, I have like branch Hyper-V reporting on a daily basis for my customers, and I can actually see if the drives are running out of space. It'll show you CSV drive size utilization, which is very important because you don't want to ever run yourself out of space on your cluster shared volume. So, all right. So, do we have time for a few questions?
Yeah, questions from the audience.
Yeah, so the question is, will the slides be available? Yes, absolutely. We're going to put up all the slides after Friday, because there's different sessions rolling in each of the cities. So I just have to capture those from each of the presenters. And then what we're going to do is we'll send that out as part of the final summary email that you guys will get. So we've got your email addresses for when you registered with Eventbrite.
And you'll just get a, excuse me, you'll get a OneDrive link, for instance, that has all the PowerPoints and stuff or PDFs included in there.
Yeah, for sure.
Any other questions? No?
Anything coming in online, guys?
Only good feedback.
That's what we like to hear, positive feedback. Another question.
You guys mentioned some performance limitation on the networking side for both CPU one.
Yeah, so basically the question is, was stemming from around the limitations of the networking stack inside of 2012 R2. So I've done extensive testing around that, and I found that I could never get more than like 300 to 500 megabytes a second. So the moment that you load the Hyper-V virtual switch and add the virtual adapters, you're technically choking that 10 gig adapter down. It's not ever going to be able to get more than that. It's by design. It's just how it is. And they fixed it in 2016. They did not backport anything back to 2012 R2. So you're going to be a little bit limited from a speed perspective. Now, that's just on the virtual adapters. The actual VMs themselves, if they're on a Hyper-V host, they can talk at 10 gig. But it's just the host-to-host traffic across those virtual adapters. So where that impacts me is if I'm not using RDMA and I'm taking one of those virtual adapters for like my live migration network, I can only live migrate at 300 to 500 megs a second. So that change in 2016 was pretty profound.
Especially
for us.
In a large environment that's huge.
Yes. Oh yeah, that's absolutely. Especially if I'm running if I've got to live migrate a 64 gigabyte RAM SQL server, I gotta move 64 gigs of that memory, that bin file, over to the other host in order to take and to allow it to come online in live migration. That takes time. So if I can get that at line speed or close to line speed, that's huge for me.
Cool, I saw it.
Yes.
Yeah, at the beginning you mentioned how a lot of people are running multiple hypervisors.
Yep.
So what do you guys see as Hyper-V's strength as a hypervisor?
So the question was, what do we see as Hyper-V's strength as a hypervisor above?
Like what workloads or what would you see as a good fit, a really good fit?
I'll let him answer first, and then I'll give you my answer.
So my answer to that is, if you're running Microsoft workloads will run best on a Microsoft hypervisor.
Well, that, hands down, there's actually, in a lab environment that I used to have, I had ESX loaded and then on one server, and then I also had Hyper-V loaded on another bare metal server. And if you run those same apps on vSphere, and you run those same apps on Hyper-V, they perform better. They do perform better. You can get more VM density for Microsoft applications whenever they run on Hyper-V. It's a proven, that's just how it is. I would say one of the kind of driving factors that seeing folks kind of make the switch is Hyper-V is generally good enough now for a lot of the deployments, right? Microsoft's made a lot of improvements. So,
and you don't see any direct head-to-head comparisons between VMware and Microsoft's, because VMware's EULA prevents you from publishing that information. That's why you'll never see Microsoft Corp actually take, or anybody really publish, those head-to-head direct statistics back and forth.
Yeah.
That EULA actually prevents that.
So your chances are you're already deploying the Windows Server Data Center Edition inside of your VMware environment, right?
Yeah.
What we're seeing folks shift is whenever the maintenance renewals and things come around. Why am I paying maintenance on vSphere, for instance, whenever I'm already getting as many operating system environments of Hyper-V? I already got it all with the Data Center Edition of Windows Server. So now that Hyper-V is generally kind of getting a lot better, that's kind of the cost is a huge driving factor.
We see that a lot in Alberta, especially right now, because of the fact of the downturn in oil and gas. And you know, companies are just trying to find ways to save costs wherever they can. Maintenance renewals is one of the huge ones that they're just like, we have no money to pay maintenance renewals on hardly anything. And the stuff that we are is just like core critical items that we're going to pay on, and the rest we're not. So I've actually seen that as a driving use case in some large organizations, probably about half a dozen of them in the last year alone, was just chopping maintenance renewals, because let's use what we already own and stop going out and keep buying all these additional things. And so it's a giant consolidation approach. It's not that they don't like and love their VMware farms, it's just they have something that is now in essence free because they've already bought it.
So does anybody else have any questions before we wrap things up? As I mentioned, I'm doing a session right after this, so you don't want to leave your seat. You want to stay right where you're at, because you want to attend and learn all about REFS, the Resilient File System, inside of Windows Server 2016. Thank you very much for coming. Before we really adjourn here, we want to make a lot of noise so the people next door know that they missed a really rock star session. So thank you very much for coming out.